Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In a world where elephants, one of this planet's most intelligent and impressive creatures, are under siege by humans, the African nation of Botswana has stood out for its efforts in recent years to protect its elephant population. The numbers speak to their success, home to 130,000 elephants, more than anywhere in Africa. But now, Botswana's president has lifted the hunting ban in Botswana, saying human-elephant conflict is a real problem, but is hunting the best solution? So this hour on Point, Botswana and its elephants. And you can join us. How would you balance the need of farmers with the need to protect elephants? Are you a hunter? Do you believe hunting those great creatures is a good way to protect them? And if not, what is the best way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we will go to Arizona, where the trial of a university instructor accused of harboring migrants along the border with Mexico ended in a hung jury this week. That'll be later this hour. But first, let's talk about Botswana and its elephants. And joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Pauline Bax, Africa reporter for Bloomberg. She's been reporting on the story, of course, and we have links at onpointradio.org. Pauline, welcome to the program.
Hi.
So first of all, explain to us, why did Botswana decide now to lift its ban on hunting elephants?
Well, this was not an overnight decision. The government prepared the ground, by having nationwide hearings about the issue. So last year, a new president came into office, Mokgweetsi Masisi. That was in April 2018. One of the first things he did when coming into office was ending a shoot-to-kill policy and withdrawing military weapons from their anti-poaching units. And that measure went by fairly unanimously approved. There wasn't much to do about it. And then after that, he floated the idea of lifting the hunting ban, not just on elephants, but on wildlife in general. And to prepare the ground, he organized he set up a committee that would organize special hearings far and wide. So in small villages, and especially in the north where most of the elephants live, to get people's opinions about the elephants. And after that, when it was clear that there was large support for this lifting of the ban, they finally implemented it in June.
I see. And so when you say there was large support, especially in the north of the country, what form was that support taking? What were people there saying?
Well, there are a lot of farmers who are scared of elephants, and you have to keep in mind that they're extremely dangerous animals. They don't go around trampling people all the time, but they do destroy crops because the north is an area where elephants live, but also where people grow most of the crops in the country. And so they come and eat them, and they look for water, and so they really trample people along the way. I mean, not every day, but you could say almost every week. And so there are some small villages where people don't go out at night for fear of running accidentally into a herd of elephants. And, you know, you don't always come out alive from that. So there was big support for the measure, especially among rural people on the countryside. And so he decided this might be a good thing to do. And the other thing that environmentalists have said is like, look, this year is actually an election year. So there will be elections in October. And this is a popular measure that's been taking. And it might, you know, help him to gain votes, especially on the countryside.
I see. But how is it that Botswana had been so successful in preserving its elephant population? Because as we noted at the top of the show, 130,000 elephants in Botswana, more than anywhere else in Africa. How did they achieve that?
Yeah, so before Masisi came to office, there was a president called Ayn Khama, who is known as a quite fervent environmentalist, and he imposed a hunting ban on all wildlife in 2014, and he implemented the shoot-to-kill policy as well. There was already a large population of elephants, but it grew quite quickly to the 130,000 they have now. He also boosted tourism, so he put Botswana on the map as a country where tourists can come and observe like this amazing wildlife in beautiful lodges. So he really boosted the tourist the tourism sector. And a lot of people in tourism obviously were very happy about that. And the other thing is Botswana is a huge country, and there's not that many people. There's about 2.3 million people, so one elephant for every 18 citizens about. So you would say there's lots of space for everybody, but apparently that's not the case.
Well, Botswana's decision to lift the ban on wildlife hunting and elephant hunting has received global attention. So let's listen to Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, answering questions last week about his decision to lift the ban. Here he is.
We have never at any time suggested we wanted to exterminate elephants. And it's quite ironic because it is we who are one of the driest countries in Southern Africa, who have homed the largest elephant population in the wild in the world.
That's Botswana's President Mokgweetsi Masisi. So, Pauline, how are Botswanans reacting to the international response to their nation's decision to lift the ban?
Yeah, the government is very unhappy with the way it's been received, even though they kind of knew that was coming. But they do think that they should be able to handle, you know, their elephants the way they see fit. And what they've also been doing is try to seek some support from neighboring countries that also have very large elephant populations, like Zimbabwe, who also, Zimbabwe, for example, sells elephants to China because it says it has too many, and to sort of, you know, rally support from countries around them and saying, look, we can do this. You know, we know how to deal with these animals. We've done this our entire lives. We live with them, and we know how to handle this. So please don't criticize us and keep coming as tourists, because we still receive tourists in our lodges, and you can still see elephants. We won't kill them all. What they will also do is invite trophy hunters, so that will generate more revenue than the usual safaris for tourists who come just to take pictures. But they say they will only allow 400 elephants to be killed in trophy hunting per year. Uh-huh. So that's not a huge amount.
Right. Well, Pauline Bax, Africa reporter for Bloomberg, speaking to us from Johannesburg. Pauline, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Dulamo Anthony Morima. He joins us from Gaborone, Botswana. He's a lawyer and political commentator for Botswana's national weekly paper, The Weekend Post. Anthony Morima, welcome to On Point.
Welcome to you, and thanks very much for inviting me on the show.
So first of all, tell us, Pauline Bax had mentioned that there's an election coming up in Botswana and that there may have been some political reasons for this decision to lift the hunting ban. Is there truth to that?
Indeed, there is. The elections are only coming on in October this year. And if consideration is had to the fact that His Excellency the President Mokgweetsi Masisi has been making some decisions that would be regarded as attractive to his political base, one can reasonably conclude that that is one of those projects or those decisions that are meant to placate his political base and therefore getting votes in the coming elections, especially considering the fact that this decision has been celebrated and ululated, especially amongst the rural people, especially amongst the people whose livelihood are mainly based on sustenance, farming, etc. And that is the political base that the ruling Botswana Democratic Party relishes on in terms of elections.
I see. Well, Anthony, I wonder if, do Botswanans see the international reaction to the president's decision as another moment in which the global community tells an African nation, we don't agree with what you're doing, but perhaps will not provide financial or institutional assistance to find better ways to manage the growing elephant population in Botswana? I mean, how do Botswanans see that?
In fact, they regard it as such. In fact, one of the things that got one worried was when some government functionaries, I think even the president himself, tried to use the Western interference card, for example, to say this is one of the cases where Western countries want to dictate terms to us in terms of how we could better manage our resources, something that has been bestowed to us by our gods. And that trump card has got leverage amongst some people, especially, like I said, his political base if you like, in that regard, which is why you would see that most of the outcry was mainly by, for example, Western journalists who are based here, Western conservationists who are based here, and the media, for example, and a lot of civil society organizations have not been keen in opposing the president's decisions. You might have seen recently when the president was in the USA, when one of the protesters spoke, asked a question, the headline from a newspaper that was covering the story there was to say President Masisi shuts down a clueless protester, obviously insinuating that that protester had no reasonable cause to question the president in that regard.
So then tell me more. What do you think is likely to happen in the next several months or in a year regarding this issue of the elephants in Botswana? Is the president determined to stay the course on this?
He is. He is. And as my colleague stated earlier, because he knows he has support on that. I think one of the reasons why the president has support on that is that this decision of the elephant ban is associated with the former president, Lieutenant General Sre Sekgama Ian Khama, and you'd be aware that several people are against him now, mainly because of his departure from the ruling BDP and his conflict with Masisi. And just like many of the projects that are associated to him, this is one project, one decision, which many people celebrate the President Masisi having reversed it. So one sees it continuing. One sees His Excellency the President being placated, obviously because of popular support in that regard. Because one of the dummies, which I call an economic dummy, that has been sent to the ordinary people is that they will benefit from the decision in the sense that they will form community trusts and they would have hunting concessions and they could bring in investors and that will result in financial dividends for them. Right. So they celebrate it for that respect.
Right. Well, Dulamo Anthony Morima, lawyer and political commentator for Botswana's national weekly paper, The Weekend Post, speaking to us from Gaborone, Botswana. Anthony Morima, thank you so much for joining us.
Kia leboha.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Botswana's decision to lift its ban on wildlife hunting, specifically elephant hunting in that nation, and the world's response to that. Let's actually go straight to the phones. Robert is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I was in Botswana about a month ago and on safari and visiting four different nature parks and saw many, many elephants, and they are majestic animals, but they really kill a lot of trees, and they eat the bark, and we saw in all four of the different parks we visited many, many dead trees as a result of what the elephants had done. And the guides we spoke to were unanimous in the feeling that they had to limit the number of elephants because otherwise many more trees would be killed, and there would be a real danger to the national parks. So I just want to add this to the discussion.
All right. Well, Robert, thank you so much for your call. So let's turn now to Richard Ruggiero. He joins us from Washington. He's a wildlife conservationist and consultant, recently retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after a 20-year career as the chief of the Division of International Conservation. He spent 17 of those 20 years on the ground studying African elephants. Richard Ruggiero, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so welcome to the program. And first of all, before we get into the specifics of the impact that lifting the hunting ban may have on elephants, I was wondering if you could actually just help us take a step back and give us a sense of the health, the numbers, and the state of the elephant population in Botswana.
Oh, that's a good place to start. Botswana deserves to be recognized as certainly a world leader in conservation in many respects, particularly with elephants. As has been stated, their population is very large. It has lived somewhat precariously with, shall we say, neighbors, and that is local communities, for a number of years. But Botswana is a tremendous country with fantastic tourism and is a country that is really quite, going there, you get the impression of predictability, which when you travel internationally is a good thing. Mm. So Botswana should be recognized as a leader in conservation. And certainly, as has been stated, they certainly have a right and an obligation to manage their wildlife populations, yeah, with elephants being the most important.
Well, so when we say that the elephant population in Botswana is very large, that 130,000 number, I guess the question is it too large? And is it too large because of human encroachment on lands that that the elephants live on, or farming? I mean, we're hearing about an increase in human-elephant conflict there. So what's driving that?
And those are two good questions that are nested. The first one, are there too many? And this is controversial because certainly, as the caller Robert pointed out, it's obvious to see a great deal of vegetation damage. Trees are damaged in areas of heavy elephant concentration, particularly in gathering points along the river and various watering points. And that is legitimate. However, biologically speaking, I think it's less impactful on the overall well-being of elephants and to some degree other wildlife that depend on trees. Certainly it has an effect. So it's something to be considered, but I wouldn't give the pat phrase that there are too many elephants there. And moving to a reason why there are, let's say, so many elephants, indeed this is a very large concentration. Human activities affect elephants in many ways, their behavior, what they do on a daily and seasonal basis. And so it's easy to understand that elephants would be affected in their occupancy, their seasonal movements, by human activities. Mm-hmm. Those human activities can be agriculture, can be poaching, can be sport hunting, can be tourism. So this combination of factors, and let us not forget that bordering countries to the north of Botswana have a rather unfortunate history with elephants over previous decades where, for example, Angola had a civil war, there are many landmines, not much law enforcement, and elephants suffered greatly. And being smart, mobile animals who communicate very well with each other, many decided to move to safer areas in northern Botswana. Huh. And those areas have been made safe by the good efforts of the Botswana government, particularly the Botswana Defense Force. But the concentration is real, and mm-hmm. in the reasons for that concentration are some solutions.
So I want to get to those solutions in a second, but it's absolutely fascinating to hear you say that the elephants were responding to human conflicts and moving to safer locations. Absolutely fascinating. But President Masisi, not only has he ended the hunting ban, but he previously ended Botswana's shoot-to-kill anti-poaching policy, right, where the military was authorized to kill suspected poachers on the spot. I wonder, I mean, what is the greater threat right now to elephants? Is it poachers or, you know, the 400 or so elephants per year that may be taken through newly legalized hunting?
Well, I'll answer that backwards a bit. Sport hunting for elephants is not going to be a huge numerical effect on the population, and those numbers are quite obvious. A fraction of 1%. But the devil are in those details. They're highly selected by sport hunters, and we can talk about genetic effects on the population of selecting the biggest and best bulls out of a population. For a species that is a dominance hierarchy, and where older, stronger elephants sort of monopolize the mating opportunities and therefore contribute a disproportionate amount of genetics into future cohorts or generations. So that's an important point. But elephants are, you know, they're not buffalo who can be more easily managed by selecting, let's say, old and in the way bulls. And that is those that are on a decline and are no longer competitive enough to mate and contribute genetically. Elephants aren't like that. And so that's an important point to consider. Also, elephants are, as I mentioned, and people I think well know, extremely intelligent, social, communicative animals who pay a lot of attention to people because they are smart enough and experienced enough to know that people are basically their enemies, that they kill them under certain circumstances. Botswana is a peaceful place, and they have much less poaching, although it's been apparently on an increase in recent years. And that's unfortunate. But in many other places in Africa, particularly in Central Africa, where most of my experience is, elephants are so endangered on a daily basis by poachers. They understand that, and I do believe they've come to the conclusion that humankind is trying its best to kill every last one, call it an animal genocide, if you will, and they react accordingly. And you can see the difference in populations that are not threatened and hunted versus those that are hunted. So these are profound effects. And so anything we do, be it agriculture, tourism, land use planning, providing water or denying it in a dry environment, all of those things have effects that may carry unintended consequences.
So there are the genetic impacts, as you were talking about earlier, of an increased taking of the biggest, most powerful male elephants. Given that elephants are also very matriarchal, though, are there any potential behavioral and social impacts in their societies?
Yes, there are behavioral, social ones as well, not the same as, for example, killing a matriarch, for example, or one of the higher ranking females. As you mentioned, they are matriarchal societies. And after the bulls, you know, as let's call them young teenagers, they get rambunctious and they're no longer quite welcome in the cow-calf herds. And so they're encouraged to leave. And at some points they get kicked out pretty firmly, and they go around in small groups of bulls or by themselves as they get older and more competitive into a state called must. And that's sort of like a rut where they become in season and they go very far out of their way to seek mates at that time. They become very aggressive and very dangerous. When a large male, that is perhaps part of the 1% of the population of elephants that would qualify for a prime sport hunted trophy, at a very high price, I might add. When that male is selected, of course, there are genetic changes, and that's pretty easy to understand. But elephants know every bull. They know the big bulls especially. They know when one is killed. That has effects on their society. It may be negative or positive. That's a judgment. But certainly on an individual basis, in particular, large must bulls are known and frankly respected among elephant communities.
Well, let's get some callers here. Let's go to Sue, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm lucky enough to have been on safaris in Africa 5 times and, of course, have seen elephants each time and have learned a lot about them over the years. And the idea of sport shooting of these sentient, intelligent animals appalls me. And I understand the environmental consequences. If, in fact, they're talking about bulls and not matriarchs, I understand that difference, too. But my first instinct is to say, well, I won't go back to Botswana again. I will go someplace where they're working, like Kenya, where they are really working to protect the elephants. Mm-hmm. And Kenya also has a shoot-to-kill rule now about poachers. And it sickens me that these animals would be used for sport.
Right.
I hope that the Botswana government can find some other way to raise money. Herds of elephants can be moved together because they're a family. I just think that would be a better solution.
Well, Sue, thank you so much for your call. Richard Ruggiero, now's the time to talk to what you see as better solutions here. Earlier in the program, we heard from Anthony Morima, who was talking about the fact that farmers or community members, especially in northern Botswana, support this idea of opening up hunting again because they've been told that they can form community trusts, that they may get concessions from the sale of the hunting licenses. But certainly that must pale in comparison to the tourism dollars that come in to see the elephants. So what is a better solution than legalizing hunting?
Well, I think let's describe it as a toolbox, and that is various implements or various tools used to accomplish your goals. But first, we must define what are the goals of elephant management in Botswana. Secondarily, what would be the goals, benefits, and perhaps unintended consequences of sport hunting of elephants? And these are decisions that can and must be made by the Botswana government, and I think they're quite capable of doing that. So, to the second part of an answer to your very astute question, what are some of the means, let's say in addition to the tool of sport hunting that can be implemented to improve the situation? Well, certainly income to local communities is important, not only as an incentive to live with, let's say, pretty bad garden pests. Elephants are not great neighbors for people trying to grow crops, and people are very justified to be apprehensive, fearful, and frankly not to like elephants very much. I think they respect them, but one can understand that they're not so happy to have them as neighbors during times of crop raising. Land use planning is extremely important. Some areas are vital for elephants, and they've likely used them for thousands of years, and they correspond to seasonal movements in a very arid environment, also easy to understand. So doing a land use planning that allows for both the needs of people and of elephants is one of the long-term solutions, and that's easier said than done. Also easier said than done are providing communities and, of course, the government that has the major responsibility to manage elephants, especially problem elephants, are deterrents. And there are ways of discouraging elephants. You know, unfortunately, they're smart enough to get around every deterrent. So you need an integrated system that uses more than one technique and can change up on the elephants to keep them away and keep them on their toes.
What are some of those techniques?
Well, people talk about beehives, and that's a legitimate way. Planting beehives around fairly permanent, let's say, gardens or farmed areas. Bees don't get along. Elephants don't get along with bees very well. They hear them. They know they're there in large quantities. They know that they defend their hives. And so they tend to move to areas. They'll move away from areas with concentrated beehives. And so you not only get the benefit of deterring elephants, but also you get honey, and you can harvest that. And so that's a successful means, but it requires support for communities to do that. It requires a level of capacity and competence to do that. Certainly the motivation would be there when they see it works, and it does. There are other ways. Fences are quite an obvious one. They are expensive, they can be effective, and they frequently fail. And one of the major failure points is that they require quite a bit of maintenance. And a lot of times, local communities who work very long hours and are out in fields, the last thing they want to do is spend a few more hours maintaining a fence. And so it can work, but there's an if involved. There's conditions involved.
Right.
So land use planning, deterrence, non-lethal, you know, the sorts of things that are used on, believe it or not, crowd control, things that flash bang, rubber bullets, capsaicin spray that's sometimes shot from shotguns, for example, and there are shotguns all over the place. They can be used.
Well, Richard Ruggiero, we've just got less than a minute to go, and I want to ask you one final question because we have been focusing on Botswana, but if we zoom out across the continent, elephants remain under threat, right? And what is the future for this magnificent species continent-wide?
Had you asked me this question a couple of years ago, I would have been much more pessimistic due to the, well, certainly competition for common resources, land, water, forage, et cetera, is always the case. And human populations are growing, so that's still a problem. But the unfettered demand for ivory, particularly in Asia, has been the primary cause of the decline of elephants. And because China is making steps, they've banned commercial ivory sale in the country. And because the government has expressed their desire to limit this practice, I think people may be starting to catch on a bit, and there's optimism in that.
Well, Richard Ruggiero, wildlife conservationist and consultant, recently retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service after a 20-year career as chief of the Division of International Conservation, 17 of those years on the ground studying African elephants. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last year, federal authorities arrested Scott Warren for allegedly providing food, water, and shelter to undocumented migrants near Arizona's Sonoran Desert. Then they charged him with harboring and conspiring to transport the immigrants, charges that could have led up to 20 years in prison. Warren, however, asserted that he did not break the law, that he was upholding religious and international compacts to aid persecuted people. He was put on trial in a Tucson federal court. And yesterday, that trial ended with a deadlocked jury. So what impact could this case have along the southern border? And we want to hear from you. What do you think about a trial against a person providing aid to immigrants along the southern border? Joining us now from Tucson, Arizona, is Rafael Carranza. He covers the U.S.-Mexican border for the Arizona Republic and was at Scott Warren's trial. Rafael, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us, a deadlocked jury. I'm not sure a lot of people expected that out of this trial. How much of a surprise was that?
It wasn't as much of a surprise. These were issues that came before a jury, but the evidence that was presented during the trial from the government was not very solid. There wasn't a lot of direct or indirect evidence that that showed Scott Warren had committed a conspiracy or had made any sort of agreement or plans to help these two migrants. However, the deliberation took about 3 days. And on the second day, at the very end, the jury sent a message to the judge that they were deadlocked and that they couldn't come up with a verdict. And at that point, the judge brought them back into the courthouse and asked them to try one more time. So they did that on the third day. And then after about half a day of deliberation, these are about 4 hours, they sent the same note again to the judge who brought them into the courthouse once again. And at that point, after asking them individually if they felt that giving them additional time would help them reach a verdict, all of them said no. So he ended up dismissing them and declaring a mistrial.
I see. So Warren belongs to a group called No More Deaths, right? What is it that this group does? And what was the basis for Warren's arrest last year?
So this group has been around in southwestern Arizona for about 15 years, and their main work is dropping off water gallons and food as well in some of the most transited areas that migrants have used. And in particular, they've been targeting an area called the Ajo Corridor, which is a stretch of very remote and rugged desert where there's very little civilization there. I mean, you have a highway basically that leads from the Mexican border to Ajo, which is a town about 40 miles north of the border, but in between it's protected wilderness. So there really isn't any way for migrants who are crossing through these remote areas to find water unless they come across one of these water drops. And then also, some drops, a few other humanitarian aid groups also do. But that's their main task, is providing that water for stranded migrants especially.
But so, Rafael, as you just said, this group has been doing this for 15 years, and yet what was the argument that the government was making that Warren had committed a felony last year? What was the argument they made in court?
So the arrest happened on January 2018, and it was a result of a surveillance operation that Border Patrol had set up on this this building called The Barn. They said that they were looking for two undocumented immigrants, and that in tracking them, they had tracked them to this location. They had arrived approximately 4 days prior, and Scott Warren was the person who had received them. And he said that he had followed no more deaths protocols and, doing a medical assessment and calling a doctor who recommended they stay off their feet because they had blisters on them. So he says he had just followed that protocol. But the argument from the government is that Warren had conspired with a director of a shelter in the nearby border city of Sonoita, and that they had worked together or come up to an agreement to help these two migrants, kind of further themselves into the United States by just, concealing them from Border Patrol for a few days.
Okay. Well, let's listen for a moment to what Scott Warren himself said a little earlier this week when the jury came back as a hung jury. He stood outside the courthouse in Tucson and read a statement defending his actions.
Today it remains as necessary as ever for local residents and humanitarian aid volunteers to stand in solidarity with migrants and refugees. And we must also stand for our families, friends, and neighbors, and the very land itself, most threatened by the militarization of our borderland communities. I've received enormous support from family, friends, lawyers, and my community.
That's Scott Warren speaking in front of a Tucson federal court. Rafael Carranza, hold on for just a moment here, because I want to now bring into the conversation Mark Kokanovich. He's joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney in Arizona. He served under the Obama administration and for 1 year in the Trump administration. We should also note that Mark Kokanovich was one of more than 1,000 former federal prosecutors who did sign a letter saying they would have charged President Trump with obstruction were he a regular citizen. So, Mark Kokanovich, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So I want to lean on your experience here as a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Arizona. What was the basis for the government to want to charge Scott Warren with aiding migrants in the desert, and were they right to do it?
Well, those are complicated questions. This case, from a broad perspective, really highlights how desperately needed comprehensive immigration reform is, because we have this humanitarian crisis at the border, and our laws don't match up well with the situation on the ground. The case that the government was trying to make also highlights problems with the immigration law, because harboring, he was charged with conspiracy, as we've heard, and conspiracy to transport and to quote-unquote harbor aliens. And harboring is defined in the statutes, or it's included along with other things in, like concealing, harboring, or shielding from detection, mm-hmm. or any attempts to conceal, harbor, or shield from detection the term in the statutes is alien, which is an interesting distinction. But that can include, you can harbor or conceal in any building or a means of transportation. So if you look at that statute in a very broad light, it can include giving an undocumented migrant a ride in your car, or, as in this case, providing food while they're in a building, because it's making it more difficult right. for the agents to detect them. Now, every prosecution, like you, your second question is, was it right to do this? When you have a hung jury like this, it usually is a good sign that it's a tough case to prove. Four people thought that it was that he had committed a crime and that the government had provided evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, but eight people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And reasonable minds can differ about whether or not a crime was actually committed, but when you have the number of people crossing the border that we do and the number of people in the country that we do, the choice about where to spend our limited resources in border enforcement and how best to spend those is really being lost,
right.
I think, when what we're choosing to do is prosecute people who are trying to prevent people from dying
yeah.
as they cross the border. So,
well, can I just jump back here to Rafael Carranza for just a moment here? Because Rafael, correct me on this if I'm wrong. One of the basis for Warren's defense that his legal team presented in court, was it a freedom of religion defense that he felt religiously compelled to aid the migrants trying to cross the desert?
That was initially part of, you know, the defense, a motion that the defense had argued along with, you know, a motion saying that this particular group, that no more deaths had been targeted specifically, so they were saying that this was selective enforcement. This was argued in court. Ultimately, the judge did not allow that. So while it was initially part of the strategy, in the end, it came up very few times in court.
Okay, all right. Well, I want to actually also just talk a little bit about how it seems as if this case is yet another highlight of a change in approach that the Trump administration is taking for border enforcement here. Because just hours before Scott Warren was arrested in 2018, the group that he volunteers with, No More Deaths, as we discussed, they actually distributed video footage of Border Patrol agents. This is footage they had obtained. These agents destroying water bottles left in the desert by the group's volunteers. And so we have a moment from this video. It's taken by Border Patrol agents themselves. And you'll hear the voice of one of the agents as he empties water onto the ground.
So you get a good shot. Pick up this trash somebody left on the trail. It's not yours, is it? All you have to do is tell me, is it yours? It's not yours. You're not going to tell me, huh?
So that's the Border Patrol agent speaking as he's emptying water onto the ground. And a spokesperson for Border Protection said at the time that the agency does not condone tampering with water or food sources left by humanitarian groups and that they seek to do their enforcement work as humanely as possible. But Mark Kukanovich, let me turn back to you here again. Are we seeing, is this another outgrowth of a change in posture in the Trump administration on how to best manage issues of migration across the border?
I think there was a clear change in posture with Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III and his speech on, you know, zero tolerance and targeting humanitarian agencies and people who are providing water is a new tactic. In his speech, he talked about how people are profiting from the harboring and transportation of immigrants, and used the death of people in this country and citizens who have been victims of crimes for at the hands of undocumented immigrants. But of course, those are highly politically charged, but the number of crimes committed by undocumented immigrants is actually lower than as a percentage than people who are here legally. And there are people dying at the border and dying in custody now, too, which is really troubling, that we have children who are separated from their families dying in custody. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think all people of goodwill are concerned about. And frankly, both parties need to do far better at coming up with solutions to this problem, because both parties have had the opportunity when they controlled the executive and legislative branches.
Well, so Mark,
and neither party did.
Yeah, hang on here for just a second. If I could, I'm so sorry to interrupt there, but I do want to at least give one listener a chance to have her say. So let's go to Linda, who's calling from Silver Cliff, Wisconsin. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, my husband and I spend the winter down in RV park near Ajo, and we've got a fence. We border 100 miles of desert. And if you see how hot it is during the day and how cold it is at night, it's just heart-wrenching when somebody comes up to that fence and, you know, asks you for a drink of water or some food. And so, no matter how you feel about immigration, you surely have to understand the desperation that these people go through to make that journey across that. I mean, the desert is very unforgiving. Yeah.
Well, Linda, thank you so much for your call. Rafael Carranza, let me turn back to you here. What do you think the effect of the fact of this case that Scott Warren was arrested? Yes, there's a hung jury here, but the government certainly sent a message with this. Has this changed the actions and activities of groups like No More Deaths? Or are they continuing to try to provide water, food, and shelter for migrants trying to cross the border?
They're very adamant in saying that their work will continue. Matter of fact, the same day that there was that the judge declared a mistrial because of the hung jury, there was a group of volunteers with No More Deaths who was driving out to Ajo to do another water drop-off. So this is something that has been ongoing, despite the arrest. And I also want to make a quick note that it's not just this jury here. The government has had some success in prosecuting humanitarian aid volunteers this year. Starting in January, an additional 8 volunteers were prosecuted for lesser crimes, misdemeanors, for entering a protected wildlife area without a permit, sometimes for littering when they dropped off some of the water gallons and the food, and 4 of those volunteers were convicted. So they were sentenced to a few months probation, and they had to pay a fine. And then the other 4 volunteers pled guilty to a civil infraction instead of the misdemeanor in sort of a plea deal there. When we're talking about a government's message, they've had some success so far. And I think that's something that the humanitarian aid organizations are going to keep in mind going forward. We know now for a fact that they haven't been using this building called the Barn as prominently as they have before. And so they're also taking notice of some of the issues that were brought up during the trial and trying to analyze how they'll move forward to address some of those issues so that way they don't become more troublesome in the future.
Well, Rafael Carranza, speaking to us from Tucson, Arizona, reporter for the Arizona Republic covering the U.S.-Mexico border. Rafael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Kukanovich, former U.S. attorney in Arizona, or assistant U.S. attorney, I should say, serving under the Obama administration and 1 year into the Trump administration, with us today from Phoenix. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems, are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.